This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Preliminary elections are underway in more than a dozen cities and towns across the Commonwealth today. In Newton, voters are going to the polls to vote for Mayor Brenda and Walter Cooper. Had a message outside the Hyde Community Center.
Just come out and vote. It doesn't make any difference, really, who you vote for. Just come out and vote.
Ditto. That's where our power and that's where our strength is.
And in Boston, the five major candidates for mayor are spreading out across the city, making those final pitches to voters.
I'm a mom with kids in the schools. I'm living the challenges. And I also have a decade of experience in City Hall, knowing how to get things done.
I'm ready to, as mayor, continue to build affordable housing and make sure that we have the best public schools in the country.
It's an exciting day. I'm thrilled that I had the opportunity to be on this ballot. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to lead this city.
You know, this city gave me everything. It took a poor girl from Roxbury and sent me to Princeton University. And by every metric, I've been successful. And I want every family, whether they're native born or they got here this morning, to have access to the same opportunity I had.
There's a lot of work that remains. I'm really proud of what we've done in 5 months, but there's so much more work and certainly hope to be able to do that work over the course of the next 4 years.
That was Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu, former City Economic Chief John Barros, City Councilors Anissa Asaibi-George and Andrea Campbell, and Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey. Now, WBUR's Simone Rios is at Florian Hall in Dorchester, joins us. Simone, welcome back. Simone, do we have you? So I don't have Simone Rios, but we're going to try again now. Simone, are you there?
Yes, I am here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Simone. It's great to be able to reach you at Florian Hall. Tell me what you're seeing there right now.
Yeah, so right now in front of Florian Hall, there's probably 20 people out holding signs. Anissa Asaibi-George, the candidate from Dorchester, is here right now. All the supporters here, the people out campaigning, are for Anissa. Erin Murphy is another candidate for city council who has some support here, but this is a very Anissa heavy area. And I spoke to one of the poll workers inside, and they're saying that they have about 300 people, 400 people so far, and that's out of 1,200 registered voters. That was as of 2:30. So this is kind of a hotbed of political activity in Dorchester.
And we can expect, Simone, that at various polls around the city, because this is a local race, that you're going to see different candidates sort of in favor depending on where you are, right?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. There's no doubt. We have colleagues in different parts of the city connecting with different candidates. Here in Dorchester. And it also depends what part of Dorchester we're talking about. Florian Hall is in the south of Dorchester. It's a whiter, kind of Irish working class neighborhood. There's a lot of support for police and firefighters. So certainly it depends on what part of the city you decide to go to.
So let's talk about that support that you've been hearing for candidates. Tell us about the issues people brought to the polls with them today.
You know, Tiziana, I've been covering Boston elections for the last 6 years, and I always ask voters what their top issues are. And almost universally, it's housing and development. This year, of course, it's COVID as well. That might have become the number one issue. But it's not the only thing. You know, people talk about environmentalism, for example, and police reform. So one of the people I spoke to today at Florian Hall is the wife of a Boston police officer, Robin McCarthy. And here's what she had to say about why she's supporting Anissa.
My husband's been a policeman, and throughout the past few years, I would honest to God say that the morale from the police has been so terrible because not just the politicians, but the public in general. Their attitude towards policemen is just terrible.
Now, you know, this could be an important issue, maybe not the defining issue in this election, but given that Anissa Asaibi-George is among the candidates vying really for second place, while Michelle Wu is expected to make it to the final two for the general election in November, I'm interested to see how this issue of police reform shapes up. Anissa Hasaibe George getting the endorsement of former police commissioner Willie Gross, for example. But then on the other hand, the other major candidates, the four other candidates, have all spoken about police reform. Andrea Campbell, for one, has talked about reallocating 10% of police budget to things like youth development and intervention. So it'll be interesting to see how that one issue kind of plays out as we figure out who the final two candidates are going to be.
This does get more and more interesting as we go along. WBUR reporter Simone Rios, we will continue to follow this with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So joining us now for an update on how the day's going is Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin. Secretary Galvin, nice to talk to you. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So yesterday you predicted about 100,000 people will vote in the Boston preliminary election today. It's about a 25% turnout.
Right.
What made you arrive at that number? And can you tell us how that would compare to sort of average turnouts in other preliminary elections?
Well, let me start by saying it's a best estimate or guess if you want. The complications are that measuring the level of interest and the uniformity of the level of interest across the city is very difficult. The other, and it's a positive complication, if you want to call it that, is the opportunity for people to vote by mail, which in previous municipal elections in Boston we did not have. It's our hope that will increase the turnout. So I made that projection yesterday of 100,000 to 110,000, believing that despite that, I didn't see the intensity in some of the requests. For instance, the number of requests for vote by mail was about 46,000 versus 60,000 last year for the state primary in September. So, but I'm still optimistic. I hope to be wrong, but at the moment I don't think I am. It's very hard to measure exactly what's happening because, once again, even though we know how many vote by mail ballots were requested and we have some idea how many have been returned, they're in the process of being returned today. People must return them by 8 o'clock tonight to make sure they're counted. In fact, we've been urging, and I urged yesterday, if you have a vote by mail ballot, do not put it in the mail. I said yesterday, bring it to a Dropbox or Boston City Hall. That having been said, the 12 noon numbers that we had from the city was we had 36,558 ballots cast. In some places, we know that does include some of the vote by mail. Some. Now, if you contrast that with the vote that was cast at the same hour 8 years ago, when again you had an open mayoral seat, it was 39,451. So it would seem as if, and that total came to 113,000 for the day. So it would seem as if we're on track for about the same. But there are some anomalies. For instance, East Boston seems to be voting much more heavily today than it did 8 years ago. And there are other communities throughout the city that are, some not as much. So we're going to wait, and we'll have 3 o'clock numbers coming in fairly soon. We'll have 6 o'clock numbers coming in. But this is really all about guesstimating what's going to come out. I'm assuming and hoping that the campaigns are trying to pull their supporters out. The other factor that's going to contribute to the turnout is where you have district council races, especially open seats, which we have 3, which I think will probably contribute to a higher turnout in those communities and hopefully bring out the turnout overall. The uniqueness of this election, the uniqueness of the field, one would hope would inspire people to vote. And as I said, I'll be delighted to be wrong and have had a bigger turnout. But when you look at the history of the turnouts, both in the preliminary elections for mayor when it was 113 8 years ago, substantially less than that 4 years ago when former Mayor Walsh was running for re-election, and then you look at, for instance, last year in the state primary, we had a lot of races, and it was only 147,000 the whole city. That was the U.S. Senate races up. And in 2018, which I looked at particularly at the state primary because you had the very hot contest then for Congress that it was ultimately won by Anna Presley, about 100,000 people voted. So the range seems to be 100 to 130, 140 is tops. So that's the range we're talking about.
So just a couple of things. First, you mentioned the uniqueness of this election in Boston. So just to remind listeners, this is the first time that a white man will not be the next mayor of Boston. So it is unique. You talked a moment ago about the deadline of 8 p.m. for people to drop off mail-in ballots. No, don't mail them at this point. point, drop them
correct.
Off. You
yes.
said drop boxes are City Hall. How can people find out?
Well, they're at drop boxes throughout the city.
Yeah, where can
City Hall.
Where? How
if
can
you go
people
to my
find
official
out?
Website, the list of drop boxes is there. If you go to the city's election department website, the list is there. In most places throughout the city, they tend to either be at police stations or public libraries, places where there is surveillance of the box itself. I will tell you also that there will be people from the election department and a police officer present towards the final hours to drop it off. So it's still not too late. If you still have your ballot, you can take it to the drop box. If you have your ballot and you are concerned about that, you might be well advised to vote in person. The fact that you ask for a vote by mail ballot doesn't mean that you can't vote in person if you've not returned it. So I would suggest that's the other alternative people have.
And if you vote by person, then obviously don't also return
well, you can't.
Right.
There'll be one of the complications this evening we're going to be confronting is they will be cross-checking late arriving ballots to make sure those people had not already voted. So that will slow things down a bit. I mean, tonight's going to be a fairly complicated count, not terribly, but we're going to be counting the ballots that are at the polling cast today at the polls. That'll be the easiest part of the process. Then the numbers will have to be adjusted for the vote by mails that were centrally tabulated. In some areas of the city, the amount of vote by mail was so high that it is going to be centrally tabulated in City Hall. The candidates have been noticed of this, and those numbers will then be added into the grand totals.
So those
will be factors that will contribute to the delay in the actual final tally.
So before we lose you, I know you're busy today. There are mayoral elections in cities across the state,
right,
ranging from Somerville, Framingham, Lynn, Newton. Are you expecting similar kinds of turnouts?
Pretty much. I mean, they vary. The intensity varies from place to place. The places that are likely to have the greatest turnout, you mentioned Somerville has an open mayoral first time in 18 years. You mentioned Framingham, where it's an incumbent seeking reelection, but there are multiple candidates. Also, Lynn has an open mayoral seat. That, too, will bring out a fairly good turnout. So we're optimistic. It'll be somewhere in the range of 20 to 30%, depending upon what it is. And their voting patterns change from city to city, too. Some places are more likely to vote in the evening. It's beautiful night, evening, afternoon. It's an opportunity for people to vote. This is positioning the final ticket. All of these are nonpartisan, so the top two, irrespective of party, go forward.
Right.
And then the November 2nd will be the final election.
We will check back in with you again. I know it's a busy day. Thank you for checking in with us. Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin there, again, giving us a little time on a very busy preliminary election day. Students in schools across the Commonwealth are back to the business of studying, and there may be a great deal to make up for in the classroom as we start our third academic year touched by COVID. One local teacher cautions us, though, that along with math, science, spelling, school districts need to make time in the school day for healing from the pandemic, from a year of racial reckoning, and from an abnormal year away from friends and socializing. Do you agree? Should schools be making space for healing? And what would you want that to look like? Or maybe your school is doing just that. And if so, tell us about it. What are they doing? Give us a call. Join the conversation. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nima Avashia is a middle school teacher in the Boston Public Schools. She made her case for healing in a recent piece for WBUR's Cognoscenti, and she joins us now. Nima, thanks for joining Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So in your essay, you ask schools to make space for kids to heal from the pandemic and this year of racial reckoning, among other traumas. What inspired you to write this and write it now?
To be totally honest, it's something that I feel like I've been thinking about since very early in the pandemic, because I learned or realized very early in the pandemic that I did not know how to be a remote school teacher. And so I started to spend time really talking with my students and creating space for them to share with me how they were doing, what was working and what wasn't working for them. And so it was over the course of the last 18 months of really listening intentionally to young people that I heard a lot of pain in their voices, and I heard a lot of struggle surfacing, and it manifested in lots of different ways. For some young people, it was around losses of family members. For some young people, it was around a loss of sense of self or a loss of connection to friends, a loss of interests. But overwhelmingly, lots of students were telling me that they were having a really hard time, and that they needed schools to figure out different ways to support them and different ways to meet the needs that we're servicing during this time. And so everything, I think, is really something I feel like that's come from conversations with young people.
Nima, can you bring that home for us? Can you tell us about one of those conversations? Obviously, you don't have to tell us who the young person was, but tell us about one of those that sticks in your mind.
A few months ago, I did a circle with a group of students responding to the idea of learning loss, which is a really common theme in the narrative around education right now. And I really wanted to hear from students what their feelings were about this idea of learning loss, how they felt about their time during school. Did they view themselves as having lost? Did they see ways in which they might have gained? And so in the context of that circle, young people were really direct in saying that learning loss certainly is something that they were concerned about. They wanted to be on sort of like on track to graduate. They wanted to be able to make progress in their academics, but there were a lot of other losses that also felt really palpable to them. And they felt like in the learning loss conversation, there wasn't a parallel conversation about just plain loss, loss of life, loss of housing, loss of stability, loss of employment, all these other losses that they also were watching stack up around them. And that I think is a really important thing for us to keep in mind. The pandemic has impacted young people and their families in tons of different ways. And so there is certainly the loss that happens when you're not able to consistently engage with schooling, but there's also a lot of other loss that the young people are holding right now.
Nima, let's go to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. We have Streamy on the line in Marlboro. Streamy, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Streamy Pailor. I'm from Marlboro, Massachusetts. I have a ninth grader who went to high school this year. My thought on in-person schooling is that it creates bonding among the kids from the same city, same community, and it helps them learn better. It fosters team building and community building. That's my thought.
Thank you for that call. And Nima, Streamy is talking about sort of the importance of those social aspects for young people. His child, ninth grade, which means middle school last year, you're a middle school teacher. Talk about that need to be, you know, with the kid pack, you know, and the friends.
100%. I mean, I think that's been one of the most sort of palpable feelings of the first 4 or 5 days of school in Boston has been that, you know, young people are learning how to be around each other again and be around large groups of people again. And there is a lot of joy that comes from that. And there's also learning that has to happen. I feel like I went to the first time I went to a larger gathering of people during this, like, I felt like I had to relearn kind of how to be in a big group again and how to navigate those dynamics. So I think it's totally right that that we need time and space in school for both for young people to have the opportunity, but also for them to sort of relearn. What does it mean to reconnect with people? That was one of the big things that students talked about. Is like, it was really hard to maintain relationships. If you don't get to see people, if your only communication with them is through technology, like, that is a very hard way to sustain relationships. Those relationships erode without the sort of meaningful physical interactions that we have in in-person school. And so if we want to rebuild those relationships, we need to make time and space for them. And that means that we might have to slow down on other things. And that's the hard part, right? Is that I think that there's definitely pressure and expectation that we sort of return to academics in a very serious way. And certainly that's necessary. But I guess the question I'm asking us to all think about is, how do we also, in parallel with that, make space for the social and for the emotional parts of this that the young people also need us to meet?
So how do you do that, especially when, as I understand it, teachers are really strained just to meet the standardized testing requirements and the academic standard requirements that regulations ask for in an academic year?
I think that's the biggest question. I think that's part of why I wrote the essay, was because I think that we need the state to lead here. I think this can't be just that, like, individual teachers and schools are making these decisions and then kind of continually in conflict over whether, like, do I make space for this need that's servicing, or do I teach this standard that I'm being told I need to teach on this date at this time by this week of this month? I think that if we were being realistic, we would talk about paring back on the standards a little bit and really trying to boil down and figure out what is most essential, what do young people need in order to progress, and are there places where we pare away? Are there places where we sort of pare back to make space for other things to happen?
And are you seeking a temporary paring back, Nima, or are you talking about permanent changes here?
I don't feel like I know the answer to that question. I think right now, for right now, in terms of the young people I'm seeing in front of me, I think we're talking about a temporary paring back. I think we need to see what happens. Like, we need to be responsive to what students are showing us. It may be that in a month, like, young people are in a better place to sort of move at a faster pace. Like, that's, you know, my gut is that this isn't, we're not talking about years of doing this. My instinct is that we're talking about what do the first months look like and how do we think about the ratio during these first months of the return to school. But I wouldn't want us to sort of like put a stake in the ground one way or the other, because I think it's really important that what we're building is responsive to what young people are showing us.
We are talking about the need for healing in schools in this third academic year touched by the pandemic. Nima Avashia is a middle school civics teacher in the Boston Public Schools. Nima, so you've said, okay, we don't know yet, a month, right? I wonder, there are those who would argue that a return to normalcy is healing. And there will be some who don't want to talk about it. They don't want to deal at school with the same traumas that they're dealing with at home. What do you do about that if you are advocating for a healing approach in the school buildings?
So I think it's 100% right that returning to routine and structure are part of healing, right? That's really important to always name. I think that there are also ways in school in which we differentiate. And that's something that we do in our classrooms all the time, which is get a sense of where young people are at and then plan for what do different students need? What do some students need to really feel healed? What are other students asking for, right? That's my job as a teacher, is to differentiate, is try to build systems that respond to all the different needs that young people are presenting. But if we don't make space to surface what those needs are in the first place, we can't do that differentiation. And so, yeah, there may be kids who are like, yeah, I'm good. I just want to do math. I don't want to talk about this. Fair. Let's figure out who you are. There are other kids for whom doing math is going to be really hard if they don't get the space to work through the pain that they're feeling. And what I don't want us to do and what I worry about is that we're actually ignoring the needs of that student.
So, Nima, what is a practical change that you're making in your classroom this year to make space for healing?
So I, in my classroom this year, am doing bi-weekly circles, which are check-in opportunities for young people where there's a series of questions that we work through as a group. Students can choose to speak or not speak as they feel moved to, but where it really is the opportunity to intentionally stop, see how young people are feeling, see what's coming up for them, and then by listening to what they're telling me, I can then make decisions about what next steps need to happen for my young people.
And remind us, what are they telling you?
They're telling us that they need relationships. They're telling us that they need time to connect. And they're telling us that they want relevant content that's meaningful to them, that helps them to feel purposeful and connected, and like what they're doing in school matters to them and matters in the way they live in the world. Those are the biggest messages I feel like I'm getting.
So just very briefly, I'm struck by this purposeful. So the kids want to feel like they matter.
Yeah, they want to feel like they matter, and they want to feel like they're, what they're learning matters. Like they can see the relationship between what they're learning and the world outside. I think young people in the last 18 months have become incredibly aware of what life outside of school looks like. And so I think it's really important to them that what we're doing in school reflects the world outside of school, provides a mirror, it provides a way to enter into those conversations. I think they really are hungry for the meaning and relevance that education can offer them in making sense of what's happening in the bigger world.
That is Nima Avashia. She is a middle school civics teacher in the Boston Public School District. She recently wrote an essay for WBUR's Cognoscenti called "What's Missing from Back to School This Year? The Time to Heal." You can find a link to this essay at WBUR.org. Nima, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, here is where we are with the pandemic in Massachusetts. According to the latest numbers from the state, the positive test rate is still hovering at 2.2%, with some 675 people in the Commonwealth hospitalized with the virus. There are 170 in intensive care. The last time we saw numbers like that was in April. President Biden has announced a vaccine mandate for all businesses with 100 or more employees, or those employees must submit to weekly testing. And today, Governor Baker is expected to speak with federal officials to get further guidance on COVID-19 third doses, often called boosters, as well as guidance on vaccines for children under 12. School is back. Traffic's back, and our questions never left. So call us. Ask the doctors, what do you need to know? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us, Dr. Davidson Hamer, infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Gabriela Andujar-Vazquez, an infectious disease physician, associate hospital epidemiologist, and medical director of the COVID-19 vaccination program at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Hamer, thanks for rejoining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, thanks to you again, too.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Hamer, I do want to start with the numbers, because it seems like we've been holding kind of steady this summer, up and down some, but hovering around a 2% infection rate. A few weeks ago, it was as high as 2.98%. What does that number actually mean? How should we be thinking about it?
I think it's a function of a lot of things, including the number of people that are presenting for testing, the volume of testing being done. And in Massachusetts, now that universities and colleges have reopened and many school systems are doing testing, often pooled testing, I think that the denominator, the total number of people being tested, is higher. So it really depends on how that figure is analyzed. But that said, you know, I think that if you look at various forms of data, the total number of new positive cases on average over a 7-day period, the proportion positive, the wastewater data at Deer Island, everything suggests we're in a plateau, that we've sort of had a rise since mid-August and then have reached a point where it's not dropping, but it's also not rising any further. And my hope is that that will change for the positive in the coming month. But there are a lot of factors, including, you know, recent Labor Day events and all the schools opening that could tilt it in the other direction.
And Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, that plateau that Dr. Hamer just talked about, what does that mean? When you hear, because you're the expert, when you hear plateau, what do you, you know, okay, so that means X is going on. What's going on that we plateau?
Yeah, plateau means good. Things are steady, not rising or lower. We want it to be decreasing, right? I think that we want, our goal would be now to try to continue our recommendations on vaccination, which have helped tremendously our state to be able to push through that surge we had in the summer, and hopefully even in the setting of opening schools, because of our higher vaccination rates and our mask recommendations and other safety measures, we are able to in the fall winter improve and decrease those numbers, along with, you know, respiratory season, other viruses that will be coming up.
We are doing Ask the Doctors, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. There are like 20 things just from those first two answers that I want to follow up on. Dr. Hamer, I think where I'll start is Dr. Andujar-Vazquez just said winter, and I almost broke into a flop sweat because winter was such a terrifying time last year. People went indoors, the weather got colder. There were all kinds of questions about what that would do to the spread, how the virus responded to cold weather versus warm weather. Should winter strike a chill in our hearts? No pun intended there.
Well, it depends on climate change. Sorry, that was back at you with a pun. Generally the fall, winter, early spring are the respiratory virus seasons for many respiratory viruses, and it's a factor of different things influencing the epidemiology, but certainly colder weather, drier air in homes, people being inside more, people having to be closer together. I mean, all these factors increase the potential for spread of respiratory viruses. So I think we need to be to have some degree of concern, but there's a lot we don't understand about the epidemiology of SARS-CoV-2, and it's sort of come in waves, and I think some of that's been driven by factors beyond climactic seasonal factors. In fact, you know, I think it's, a big part of it's been sort of the susceptibility of the population, and then it, more recently, the impact of vaccination, but also the variants of concern. So it's really hard to predict. It could potentially get worse during the winter, but it also might calm down this fall, and we could have the end of a wave rather than the beginning of a new wave.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John's on the line in Boston. John, what's your question?
So I am fully vaccinated with the Moderna vaccine. I have a question. My question is, if I'm in close contact with somebody who tests positive for COVID, do I need to quarantine?
Thank you for that question, Dr. Andujar Vazquez. What are the guidance? What's the guidance from the state?
Right. So the guidance from the state is no. If you're fully vaccinated, you do not have to quarantine. Where it gets a little bit confusing for folks out there is because CDC and DPH do have a little bit of a different guidance. Our state says no quarantine and no testing, just monitor for symptoms. And if you have symptoms, go right away and get tested. CDC, because they, you know, have to talk to make recommendations for different states, right, do say that if you're fully vaccinated, you don't have to quarantine also, but they do recommend testing at day 4 to 6. But our state is no quarantine if you're fully vaccinated, and just keep monitoring those symptoms and be careful, you know, around other people while you're in that period of exposure.
So, Dr. Hamer, as Dr. Andujar Vazquez was answering that question, I've got a glass wall and I can see into the control room, and eyebrows shot up a little bit in surprise over that state guidance. And then, of course, we hear CDC guidance is a little different. Are you glad that we are particular to the needs of the Commonwealth, or is there a risk that when the guidance is different at the state level than it is at the federal level, that people get frustrated and muddled?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, I think, you know, by and large, the state, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health has been following the CDC guidance fairly closely. I mean, there's some minor changes. And yes, I mean, it states are allowed to make their own decisions. They, you know, federal guidance is just that. It's guidance and it's not mandatory. You know, I think there's a need for harmonization, but sometimes in different contexts, it may make sense to have either, you know, stricter guidance or slight variation. So it does become confusing, though.
So let's go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. Karen is on the line in Scituate. Karen, what's your question?
Hi. So I'm one of the 14 million people that received the J&J vaccine. And I keep thinking, you know, what about us? I'm not hearing very much in the way of guidance regarding a second shot. So like to hear the doctor's thoughts on that.
So, Dr. Hamer, I'm going to stay with you on that one. And just for listeners, a second shot, because the J&J vaccine was a single-dose vaccine, unlike the two mRNAs where you did a course of two shots. Dr. Hamer.
Well, Karen, that's an important question. It's interesting. The New York Times did a whole piece just on this because so many people said, what about us? We got the J&J. What should we be expecting? And the honest truth is that there are probably that vaccine, too, will need a booster. There are different studies been going on looking at the duration of the immune response, both antibody production, but also cell-mediated immunity. And I think that many of us feel that there's a definite need for a booster with that. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, is it going to be a booster with the same exact vaccine, or are we going to do some vaccine mixing? Does it make more sense to go start with that and then do a messenger RNA vaccine? Because there are some open questions about that, and also open questions about when the optimal time for booster is, I think it's hard to give you advice at this point in time, but more likely than not, at some point in the not-too-distant future, a booster will be recommended for people that have the J&J vaccine also.
Dr. Andujar-Vasquez, let's stay on this question of boosters or third doses. There have been some conflicting messages recently. Pressures from some in Washington on boosters. The Biden administration declared they were coming. There's been pushback about timing from the FDA. And now a group of scientists yesterday came out and said, we don't think people need a third dose. Again, you worry about mixed messaging frustrating people, especially those who may be teetering on the brink about whether or not to get vaccinated in the first place. So which is it? Boosters are going to be necessary or they aren't?
Right. So definitely a lot of conflicting information that can confuse people. But at this time, you know, we know just based on the scientific data that we have for all the three vaccines that are authorized in the U.S. that there is some degree of waning immunity in fully vaccinated individuals for the asymptomatic to mild illness. Right. There's still strong protection against severe illness, hospitalizations, and death against COVID. Right. But the timing of when that waning immunity happens in a person that has a good immune system is still unclear. And that's what the CDC and the FDA are trying to unfold with data. And unfortunately, with data, we need time, right, to make those observations. It seems like by knowing other vaccines, that elderly population are more vulnerable for this to happen, right? With time, they seem to have more waning immunity. To the vaccine that may be a healthy individual. And so it's possible that boosters will be recommended, but specific populations where they're more vulnerable to have waning immunity or are vulnerable for different reasons, like healthcare workers that need to be healthy and ready to take care of patients. So I think that's where the middle ground standing, making sure that the timing is right, that the federal government's ready to give those boosters to everyone in the nation, but also making sure that it's with the appropriate science behind it.
And just staying with you for a moment, Dr. Andujar-Vasquez, the FDA on Friday is having a meeting about the Pfizer vaccine, which is fully FDA approved now, and its administration as a booster. What would a decision in one direction or the other mean for people on Friday?
Right. So they're meeting to discuss only Pfizer, which is, as you said, the one that's fully approved. I think that, they will be discussing boosters and whether there are certain populations that would benefit from this. There may be a recommendation coming from them about, based on the data, whether, maybe the elderly population should be that population we should be thinking about boosters in the next couple of weeks. But they will be only discussing Pfizer, not the other two vaccines. But the process is typically that the FDA VRBPAC meets, and then CDC with ACIP, the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, which is the advisory committee for all of our vaccines in the United States that makes recommendations, will be meeting following that. So still, a lot of meetings to happen before we have a clear picture of what will happen with boosters.
1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus and vaccine question. We have Frank on the line in Ayer. Frank, go ahead.
Hi there. My doctor tells me I shouldn't be vaccinated because of immune system deficiency, and I'm looking for a job. Every job I've looked for, they require a vaccination. So I'm asking whether there's some way of boosting my immune system to be able to overcome that. I've heard that probiotics may be good for that, but I know nothing about probiotics.
Thanks for that call, Frank. And Dr. Hamer, I'm going to turn it to you, and I'm also going to acknowledge that you can't provide specific medical advice to a specific person who's not your patient, but let's address Frank's question.
Okay, that's a tough question, Frank. I mean, there are actually medical exemptions allowed for vaccination status by many organizations. And if your doctor feels that whatever the underlying cause of your immune system weakness is such that it can't easily be reversed, then one option would be to get a letter from your doctor saying I have a medical exemption from vaccination, and most organizations would accept that. There are ways to strengthen your immune system, and it really depends on what the underlying cause is. If it's due to a medication, sometimes reducing some of the medications, if that can be done in the context of your underlying disease. I'm not sure probiotics will help, honestly. Having adequate intake of zinc and vitamin D, vitamin A is really important for normal immune function, but I wouldn't necessarily go out and take a lot of that without your doctor's advice. So it's sort of a tough question, but I think that the real key part is you're having a discussion with your doctor about whether you could get a formal letter stating that you have a medical exemption.
It does seem like Frank's call, in fact, reminds us that that's what a medical exemption is for, and there are accommodations for that. Thanks for that answer, Dr. Hamer. Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, I want to pick up on a thread, something you said earlier, where you talked about vaccines in asymptomatic and mild illness. And I want to pick that up because the numbers in the Commonwealth, 4,750 new cases, 52, I can't seem to get that number out, 4,752 new cases over the weekend. But the daily average of COVID deaths is now 9.4. Now, the record low daily average was 1.1 in July. But I am also mindful that in the spring of last year, for example, April of 2020, we had a record high one day of 250 deaths. Every death is a tragedy, and I make not light of one of them. But we are seeing a significant difference in fatalities. And it feels like as we talk about the Delta variant, we talk about vaccinations, we talk about trends and numbers, it's important to sort of recognize that too.
Absolutely. I think that the vaccines have saved thousands and thousands of lives right now, and there's data showing that. And I said this earlier, we're fortunate that in the Commonwealth, we have higher vaccination rates than in other states, and that have virtually protected a lot of our vulnerable population that would have died otherwise from COVID-19. And even though, you're fully vaccinated and you may pick up asymptomatic infection, that's what the vaccine was produced for. It was produced to avoid severe disease, to avoid hospitalizations, to avoid deaths, and that's exactly what it's been doing. And it's why when you compare our numbers and our surge back in spring of this year and back in fall winter 2020, it's definitely made a difference. And I think we can make more of a difference if we keep our vaccination rates going up, get those primary series doses out there, and making sure that, now that we're going into those cold months, that we're all doing our part to keep everyone safe.
So, Dr. Hamer, Frank called from Maynard. He did not want to stay on the line to ask his question, but it's a good one, and I'm going to bring it to you. It's a two-part question. First, when do we at this date think that vaccines for kids under 12 will be available? And then the second part of his question is, he has a daughter who is an 11 and a half. And I think he is assuming that at 12, you get a bigger dose, an adult dose of the vaccine. Children under 11 or 11 and under get authorized, should he do it immediately, or should he wait till she turns 12 in the thought that there might be a bigger dose she would get then?
Okay, I mean, both of those, I think if I heard correctly, they're planning a review very soon, I think, of the Pfizer data for 5 to 12-year-olds, and that means there's a small chance that we might have approval in the next month or two. I mean, originally I'd been hearing as late as December or January for that, and Dr. Andujar-Vazquez might know more. I'm not sure what the concentration of messenger RNA is that they're using in children under 12 versus 12 and older, so I can't answer that question.
Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, can you?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right, Dr. Hamer. They did move the timeline a couple of weeks, months. We were thinking it was going to be under 12 years of age in January, December, but it seems that they're going to start, at least for Pfizer, reviewing the data in the next couple of weeks, October probably, and we'll make a decision by November. So the question about whether he should give the vaccine, you know, because she's in that between 11.5 to 12. I think that as soon as it becomes available to them, they should just give the vaccine that is recommended. The dose, I'm not sure what dose will end up being. It's very likely that it's based, because it's usually weight-based, that it will be similar to the 12 years of age, the dosing, for 11 to 10, usually. So I think when we start hitting less than 10, it tends to be a different dose, but that's what I think will happen. So I think that as soon as they get approval and they're under 12 still, that they should get whatever it is recommended.
So it's the same as it was in the spring, which is when you can get a vaccine in your arm, get a vaccine in your arm, full stop.
Right.
So, and I do want to note, Dr. Rochelle Walensky did say yesterday that they are looking at the Pfizer data now. She said that on NBC's Today show, just to add to what the two of you said. So, Dr. Hamer, I'm going to come back to you, and I want to ask a question about herd immunity. We heard this week that the CDC says that about 75% of American adults have at least one shot in their arms. We know that the Delta variant, heartbreakingly, is ripping through the country. At some point, one would think that between having had COVID and if the majority of those adults follow through and get their doses, and I recognize kids are a question mark, but we are now talking about a time frame for kids under 12 to be vaccinated. Is it time to revisit the question of herd immunity, and is it now something that could happen in the United States?
Well, it's a tough question for a couple reasons. You know, one is that we are starting to see at least some effectiveness studies are suggesting waning immunity because many people are now 6, 7, 8 months out from their initial series. And that has implications for protection against symptomatic infection. And so to really prevent transmission altogether, we need to have a vaccine that prevents both asymptomatic transmission, but also development of symptomatic infections. And the protection of all three of the currently available vaccines has gradually decreased over time. And that may be a factor of time since the primary series, but it also may be a factor that impact of the Delta variant of concern. So I think it's a little hard to say that we'll actually attain herd immunity in the current context. Certainly, if we can get vaccination rates up to 90%, and if it ends up being useful to have a booster, if that strengthens our immunity, we might be in a better, you know, might have a better opportunity to reach that. But otherwise, you know, the problem is that if the vaccine doesn't block transmission altogether, then that makes it harder to attain herd immunity.
Just very briefly in follow-up, because we're almost out of time, does that mean we could be chasing this in waves for a very long time?
Potentially, but again, you know, I think that if we end up learning that boosters greatly, you know, sort of strengthen the immune response, it may be that we'll be able to control things, at least in the United States. But we have to vaccinate the rest of the world, or make sure they're vaccinated, because there's going to be this constant risk of reintroduction of potentially new variants of interest and of concern from different parts of the world.
All right. That is Dr. Davidson Hamer, infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Gabriela Andujar Vazquez, an infectious disease physician, associate hospital epidemiologist, and medical director of the COVID-19 vaccination program at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks, doctors, to both of you for helping us with Ask the Doctors today.
My pleasure. Thank you.